Tell me what you're talking about, too.
For the whole thing?
Yes.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
This is the man. There it is. Okay, so, like part of what he said, it's going to be more useful and interesting. The interesting stuff comes in September, but he forced me to do a short one to make sure that I wouldn't crap my pants here or whatever. So I'm going to talk about a piece of rate monitoring software that I've written in 2009 and that has gotten some feature efficiencies. GeoWatch, it is a port for census utils. Fairly widespread use based on the access logs of my mirrors, whatever. The history of this is I was doing some consulting before I became a system administrator for NYI. And one of these people needed a file server. I'm like, great, I'll build your machine. He said, well, what if I get a Dell one? They say they've got RAID monitoring. And Dell RAID monitoring, as we know, is either for Windows or it's just a nightmare because it's closed, or you have to use some simulation, and if you don't have the right utilities, and if you actually want to do something useful with it, it's going to fill your terminal with garbage. Anyway, so he said, sure, I'll write you a script. And so, of course, before setting off to write the script, I looked for other scripts on Google. And people had hacked various things together over the years, but I didn't find anything kind of, you know, ambitious. So I thought, okay, I'll go check out how to do this, what I thought as properly. So I'm a C++ programmer. So I went and I looked at the Lubito and the GeoWatch libraries. I took apart the Jupyter binary of it, figured out how it interacts with the kernel API. The documentation was not heavy there, so it was a fun reverse engineering exercise. Something came out that NYU uses a bunch of implementations. So quick slide quoting here. Its purpose is to keep an eye on disliked things in previous disk, and if something is wrong, it'll tell you so that you can take corrective action like replace the disk. Some of the design goals are contradictory in practice. It would be nice if it was broadly useful to a bunch of people and could monitor a bunch of different disk-like things, RAID, encryption, simple disks, what have you. It's nice if it's programmer friendly, just because I'm the programmer. And it's nice if it's administrator friendly, because most of you and I am an administrator. I've gone over this already. So if any of you remember these nice papers and talks from PhD and PJD about how genome is an infrastructure, it's nice to have 21st century code living amongst, you know, a bunch of corrupt like CCD and RAID frame and all these other nightmarish things, LVM. And being nice infrastructure lends itself to a bunch of features being built on top of it. Some of them I've named a minute ago, and a bunch more are there's a disk class, which is pretty much a one-to-one mapping between a disk and a genome provider. There's mirror, which is RAID 1. There's RAID 3, which is RAID 3. There's ELI. There used to be an old one, GDBE. ELI is the kind of modernized version of it. There's gate. You can export character specials and files over TCP. There's label. You can label other genomes. There's RAID 5. That's not in the tree. There's RAID 0, genome stripe. A bunch of things that we can do with it. And so without treating any of these specially, a design goal of mine when writing this was so that you can monitor all of them, rather any one of these with a simple configuration line, and that it would kind of figure out what the right thing to do was. And since ZFS was kind of the cool thing that came outside of previous, you know, it was developed around the same time frame as GeoGebra and Solaris, of course, as an exercise, I thought, oh, what the hell, and I added support for last year. So that's like the second thing that runs in that while loop. One is the genome code and the other one is the ZFS code. While one, check genomes, check ZFS. So in terms of how it's organizing the code, I don't like writing things to the file system unless I must. And I think the only things that I must write to the file system are the PID. So that the RC system knows whether this thing is running and how to kill it. So this is a writing thing. This has edge cases. For example, if a machine has a radar rate that's being monitored by this, and it's out of two disks, let's say it's full, and then the machine crashes and the machine restarts, and if this dies while the machine is coming up, this will not detect that because it didn't keep the state from the previous reboot, saying, oh, this has to have two disks. It'll just, you know, basically if things, the state starts up into the correct state, so it won't have noticed that disk. But this is a trade-off I'm currently deciding to make in the effort of making this code kind of as elegant as it can be before it does. So some things I ran into, kind of half on the kernel side, half of all the stuff you can do is, these things behave differently based on what the GRM class is. For example, if you've got an error, it's in a usable state when just one disk is up, and if that dies, all of them fails. Conversely, if the stripe is up only when all of them are there, and it dies if just one of them fails. And various combinations of this effect. And also, if you know anything about the user space kernel interaction between GRM, the actual kernel code exports GRM status in only XML form. So there's no binary interface that says, oh yeah, if some and some bit is one, then this thing is in a happy state. No. It's XML, so it's ASCII VNs, and of course what this means is that all these various geomodules that take liberties of what to call their complete statuses. So some examples are in geom error and geom rate 3, there's a complete status, and I think it's degraded for both of them. Geom strike, it's up, not complete, up, it's great. Label ELI and a bunch of these other one-to-one dismapping ones, you all can be bothered to come up with any word to describe it, so they just looked at an NA. That's all fine and well, except if you want to generalize something that queries whether or not something is in a good state or not, it's horrible. So of course, in the effort of keeping this elegant, I'm not going to go and have case statements based on what the class is and what its status is, since that would kind of limit me to the amount of stuff I can monitor. And the previous goal is I'd like to monitor every single GRM class that's ever invented. So, in the interest of kind of generalizing future proofing this, what I've done is I've stopped caring about all those details. The checking sequence is fairly simple. When it starts up, it does a basic check about, and it does, it checks whether the class is even there and if the GRM is there. If it does, it just treats whatever its current configuration is as the correct state. Following that, every so few seconds, whatever you configure, it checks whether there are any missing components in that class. And if there are, it complains by email to any number of administrators. Also, if it encounters an error in checking a GRM, it'll send a similar email saying, oh, I can't check this. And that takes care of a nice case, the case being, if the thing is just in unavailable state, for example, if it just disappears, it will just not be in that GRM XML tree. Or if you lose all the components of a mirror, for example, or if you lose one component of a stripe, GRM will not give you access to your class. So you'll get an email saying there's an error checking this, GRM not found, and you can log into the machine and see, oh, I've lost this in something that doesn't tolerate the failure and can't abort me. Okay, so for the last part of this, some things I ran into when writing this were, like, for example, GeoMirror plugins into Magios. And working at NYI, I maintain some machines that are part of this big cluster of, you know, machines. But, like, for example, DNS servers there are just these machines out in the world that I'd like to have reliable storage. It really pains me as a system administrator to have to install some kind of monitoring infrastructure just to monitor this on the system, which for sure will fail. Like other things, I have various degrees of confidence in that they'll never crash, like well-written code. But this, I know are going to fail, so I like to monitor them, whatever the machine is. And so I'd rather have something that doesn't require 90 OS or some other kind of sledgehammer solution. And so this thing requires with ESMCP, which is a tiny Yosemite library, and that's it. So you install it, you edit the sample configuration file, and you run it. And it just watches stuff for you in the background. It takes less CPU time than powered D. So even though it's polling as opposed to interrupts from Geom, since Geom can't send interrupts, the functionality isn't there. So it just loops to check your stuff. If it detects failure, it'll email you. This is fine because everybody checks their email. Most people check their NIDOs. Previous decomms with a working MCA by default, SunMail. And that went over the last bit and shooting the fail. So that's the end of the talk part. For your time and or interest for a demo?
Demo.
Okay.
We'll do it better again.
Are you going to drop your laptop so the disk dies?
I brought some USB disks since I like my laptop.
I can bring it back.
Yeah. So let's see here what we got.
On the side, what I've been doing for a long time is I just have a script that I dump in, I edit it for the, runs on the local host, every, whatever, periodically, and if it sees incomplete or anything else in Gmir or in any other RAID, it emails. What's the case for using this GeomWatch over just the basic dump script?
So one key thing you mentioned was it checks for complete, right?
Well, it'll say, okay, if the output is incomplete or failed or whatever,
right.
Whatever the particular RAID failure is.
The core thing is important. You need some kind of prior knowledge of what it has to parse, right?
It's just reading what the output signal is of fail or complete. If it's say it's Gmir and it's complete, and then if it's failing, it says incomplete. It'll say on incomplete.
Degraded,
whatever. Yeah, I'm talking about like six different grades. Asking something or something.
Right. So that kind of has finite use, right? This is meant to be really general. So because it creates the API, it can detect whether or not it's missing a component. Your thing, it'll work for as much as you know how to parse. For example, if someone imports like GeomRAID 5 into base after how long they've been developed in, like 10 years, whatever, if it ever comes there and the guy decides to make a complete state, rainbow. So if it's in the rainbow state, and if they also can be the cold state, just for some crazy reason, because they can, right? Because we're trying to export the stuff in XML ASCII, not some binary stuff. You will have to know about it, and you will have to modify your thing. But my thing will kind of just do the right thing, because, querying the Geom API, it knows it's all components, it knows that one's lost, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess it's kind of a generalization versus prior knowledge of what you're parsing things.
So basically,
yeah.
Same
difference. Yeah, actually, it's the same, because I have to edit it. Like, I'll use it with, with Gmir, I'll use it with, all the other hardware RAID drivers, VapTec,
WStar and Hardware RAID,
TWCLI, any of the apps, what's the LSI one? It's the LSI RAID utility.
The native ones that are recently imported in, I think, 8, there's the new ones, there's MFI util and MPC util. For the future ones.
The old one, the AMR stat.
Yeah.
But like, it's like, okay, well, if it fails in AMR stat, it says this.
Yes.
Change the script to that. It's all like...
But that's kind of like some pseudo-vendor lock-in with the hardware RAID stuff. I mean, only very, very recently they've even given out specs about those cards, right? This is why MFI uses an MPT show up. 99% of the stuff, you get a previous G binary statically linked to like previous G5, and you hope to God that it doesn't have bugs that to your production server. Or before that, they used to give you a Linux binary and it emulated Linux IOCTLs to the device node.
Well, the LSI one, I don't think that's the case, but also, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that thing, forget it, that thing, for example. But I don't think it, and then also High Point, right? I mean, it's ugly, but I have a reasonable confidence that it's correct if it tells me the raise fails or the raise work is up.
Yeah.
Anybody else on that?
I like better than reasonable. I like having the source.
Oh, no, of course. We're debating about how to notify, not hardware, binaries, and so on. So I see how it interrelates, but the question is that, so what? So if I just use Gmail, who cares? You know, that's why I raised the whole point of script.
You see the demo.
You see the demo.
They want to see working, right. Working project.
Who has a hammer?
I'm the guy.
Who's a hammer?
Okay, so I've got two disks here. I've got DA1 and DA0, which are these little USB things. Now, what are we doing on them? ZFS, GMIR, or something else? Who votes? No one cares? All right, GMIR.
Come on. ZFS sounds better.
Okay, let's see if I remember how this goes.
Create.
Is it type first? Let's try that, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, let's try that. Fuck you. Fantastic. Okay, so this is what it looks like when it just is installed. Do you have faith that I was able to compile this successfully on my system prior, or do you want to see that?
It's like you're wearing one user.
Well, it's in the ports tree, so it passed the tinderbox at some point. And we call this thing test. And let's make it check this thing a bit faster. So my laptop's called T41. And I'll send it to my Polymail using my local sendmail MTA thing. So
you got two apps in there.
You're right. Thank you. Okay, so it didn't yell at me about the configuration, which means that it found all the pools and geom stuff that I told it in there. So there it is. And here's my pool in its online state. And here's my mailbox. This is George telling me that the meeting starts at 6:45. And I'm going to pull out one of these disks here. And, oh gosh, it changed into degraded mode. And, oh my goodness, what happened here? Yay.
That's amazing, a demo in a forest.
That's actually never happened in 8 years.
Okay.
Excellent. I knew you could just read a rating.
Cool. Where's the robot that put the new disc back in?
George?
Jose, yes.
inside NYI joke. His name is Armand.
I can taste this apartment.
One more question.
Yeah.
Right, GM related question. All that XML stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is, wow, I didn't know that.
In fact, hold on. I think you can get a straight up giant dump of it. Let me try to remember the CC code real quick.
Or
you can stop me if this is too much of a detour.
Yeah.
Found it. Kern.geom.conf.xml. It dumps the entire geom XML tree as it is given to the system by the kernel.
Okay.
So your disks are in there, your partitions are in there. There's a big disk one. My ADA 0. All your like fancy stuff, RAID, encryption, whatever, is in here.
Where exactly did that convention come from? That's right.
Now, your question, what's the best practice for now this very wild, data format with so many possibilities? What happened to standard I/O? And I can't believe that this would be PHK's idea.
Right? He wanted something that XML is known for, extensibility, so you can find the ease of things, because there are a bunch of fields here that are only going to apply to like a single type of class, right? And so in this paper that I linked to, actually, I think, in the original PHK paper about this, I think this is the one that he talked about this thing and says, we need something, you know, basically with the properties of XML, and then he says, oh, look, there's something actually here in XML. Now I know that XML in 2011 in BSD Crowd is associated with terrible things like Java and Ruby and XMLRPC and just human unreadable garbage, but at the very least, I will say that this is a reasonable use for XML. It's not sprawling.
Anybody else? So the XML is inside the kernel?
Inside the kernel. There are some callback functions in the Istio module that basically write XML to a C string based on what the status of various things is. And they return a pointer to that C string, and then you've got the various, you know, kernel user space copy functions, copy out, and you get this from the Istio.
Too bad we can't write that.
I think we need to answer that. That audience has spoken. Okay, then. Thank you.
Bruno,
where's the beat?
Bruno, you want to wait another 6 months or tonight?
I'm called that Bruno Fears.
Is this you, Bruno?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll need a 25-minute intermission to get OpenBSD to output.
Good thing it's Windows.
Oh, it's Windows.
XR now.
35 minutes.
That's what I use.
You plugged in?
Text Ivan and tell him to start fucking with your raids.
But it says it was fine. I don't know why it didn't get worse.
This?
Yeah.
To shut down the file with
you.
File
03. Yes, sir. What is that? A
T1? Set up some XML file.
What? What is that? X12?
What resolution?
48 by 6, it works. 800 by 600 is
640
by 48.
It did 1024 when I looked into it.
Well, wait, 1024? Bruno, I think you're going to go function F5 or something like that.
I don't think alcohol.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it, but... Is she going off? Ta-da! Wow. Did you actually see the white apple in the vase? All right, everybody can see?
Yep.
Oh, okay. I think you might have to turn up.
Hello.
Yay!
Okay, it's just the slides. Slides 2. Yeah. And okay, to start, this is useful sometimes, especially if you have a router with SPF or a firewall, you router. But you can also use it on standalone servers to kind of monitor bandwidth in and out, just in case you want to check your ISP or you want you have some security concerns, you can set up some scripts to monitor if some of your ports that are supposed to be low traffic or pushing traffic, things like that. So this is the most basic rule. It comes by default in OpenBSD, I think. In the external interface, you define your ports, and basically we're gonna change the bottom row that says pass out.
Slow down, bro.
Don't pass out. So the only change is this label on the bottom. You basically label the row, and then later you can so you use pf control -vs, and you can see this output. Basically you have evaluations, number of times this rule was evaluated, number of packets and bytes. Mistakes, but you know, careful about here. So you can then parse this in any way you want. You can. There is also a command to pip control to zero out the label rules. So you can run it from cron or whatever you want, like every 5 minutes, or you can do cumulative. Or if you want, you put it in the. You can parse and put it in a database for accounting, like monthly traffic to port 80.
Can you
XML?
Sorry?
Say it again. Does
it dump XML?
No, you would have to do that yourself.
You die in your turn.
This is another rule, call it more complex, but it's just to show you another example, a different example. So here the rule passes in any TCP traffic to ports 80 and 443. And then you can add a label. These destination address and destination ports are built in into PF, and this basically will keep accounting per IP and port. So it looks like this when you display it. So if you have multiple IPs, you can also put source IP. And I don't know about source port, but you might not want to do that anymore. So this way you can, for example, parse it, perform, and do some basic accounting. Well, you can add a different, another flag, L, and get a lot more output. This is relatively recent in PF, maybe a year or two. So here you get buckets in, bytes out, for example. And then again, you can parse it and graph it. There is a package, at least in OpenBSD. I don't remember the name, because it's been a while. But basically, it can help you. It just makes graphs. Basically, you set up a
new plot.
No, one of the OpenBSD guys wrote it. I'll look it up.
You put it up on a page, on a nice book page, so we can look it up. Oh
yes, so
look at your talk list.
You got it. But you can also do it yourself. I don't know. We put it in database to do math and accounting. Of course, there is no limits here. And that's it. It's pretty simple, and you can do it relatively quickly. And just have another, you know, in case you have a problem, you don't have to install some tools to, let's say, see how much am I passing to this port or that port. You can just do PF control and, you know, kind of eyeball it real quick. Yes.
So, any idea how expensive it is to add labels, to be counting based on labels of PF, in terms of your package
wrapper? I don't know. We never noticed anything. We had the OpenBSD firewall that was running, which was a P3 IDE box. Of course, didn't do it for Google either, so, you know. But I don't think it has that much overhead.
It's probably just as expensive as a rule, right, with some additional memory use for the actual account.
Yeah, I think you're right. It just has another data structure or something to keep this bytes. A question?
Have you come across any... so you use the heap state rule, right? So it makes a state entry for every PC session? Alright?
Well, heap states,
yes,
not by default now.
Have you found any way to extract statistics from the states, like right as they expire? Or there's no interface for that?
Yeah. You can list the states, and it's been a while, but you can list the states and see the established states, which are current and then expired, similar to what NESTAD can show you. If you do NESTAD-NA, you can see the states in the TCP states, like established or thin white or whatever they are. So maybe you can use that to track. But that's just regular PF stuff. Like George said, keep state is built in now, but a couple of years ago it wasn't, so that's what we want. Yes.
Could you go back to the slide that shows the syntax for label with the destination IP in port?
There are a few other directives that are built in, or you can name them
you know, sometimes instead of destination address, you say web server 1 and ports, you leave in numbers.
So the destination address and port are filled in by the app, or is that something you've set up?
Right, this is filled in by the app. This is built in. It's just like a variable you use.
So it's documented in MANPF, maybe?
Yes, manpf.com.
Okay.
And I think you can do source address and port.
Yeah,
I'm doing counting not only input but only on the output. And I
want
to see
how many
users are
going out for. The bytes that output.
Yeah, basically not the input,
you
guys,
input
output
from
my firewall.
Yeah, the output itself is already there. I just don't remember if you can track it by source or in your case destination IP and port.
Meaning
clients outside of your method.
Firewall, right? You have a bunch of PCs at home, and you want to see which one is considered more valuable. Or you're pumping out the name traffic. You want to see the counting by your users in trouble. How would you do that?
So you want to see outbound traffic?
Basically, yeah, you have a firewall and you have a bunch of PCs or users unknowns. Who's downloading who's?
I think you can do the same rule, just do the pass out rule.
So you can even put in rules where it shows packets per second. Because I can do 10 megs, so he's doing 1,000 packets per second. Like voice of IP.
Right. No, this is just... whenever you, let's say, do PF control -VS, you'll see some numbers. There is no per second.
Basically, you
can
get that by your sample rate. Yeah. If you set more
right.
Than you can get some notion of change
over time. Yeah, this is more maybe for total accounting type
yeah.
Stuff. And if you want instantaneous traffic, yeah, unless you do it yourself every 5 minutes and there's some triggers. The market is still complex. But for your question, I think if you reverse the rule and use the same label, that should do it. Just do pass out.
Pass out on the song interface. And
you know, because it's the way PF does things. You know, you can do it on input queue and output queue and...
Say, I'm interested in the source. If we would have passed out an internal interface,
well, you can do it in multiple ways.
It's initiated from the control network outside. So it's going to be created there. Say, you have the control interface and transformation of that.
So you can do it in this rule or a similar rule, and there should be, it's either a destination or a source, the labels.
The only thing I'm asking is there built-in other built-in variables for source port and source address?
I think so, but I'm not 100% sure.
Right.
But I think there is same as for destination, there is for source.
Okay, thanks.
But what I'm saying is, if you reverse the rule, you can use destination IPs and ports, I think. You know, pass in, pass out. Depends where you write your label. If you have two interfaces, you could also write these rules on your internal interface.
The state is created by the, and that goes out.
Right, but there are two interfaces. So you only do it on one, or you can do it on both, but then the rules flip.
On both, the packet goes into the internal NIC, and has the same idea of source 4. And goes out, from the external interface, and still the same, the source AP is different from the external network, it's a registration. But still,
yeah, well, if anyone has a PS montage, can check it out. Yeah, we can talk about it. Any other questions?
In a most practical sense, like if you have clients in a cabinet, you're doing hosting. I mean, how would you do it off the PF firewall? Would you just dump this to syslog and then do the accounting from there? Like, say you wanted monthly accounting of bandwidth usage in and out, and you're trying to just calculate bandwidth usage per client, per by IP. How would you do it? How would you set it up?
One way to do it is to run the output and put it in a database. So if you parse by IP, let's say you have 10 clients or 10 dedicated boxes, you parse per IP, and then depends if you want to parse per port. I guess it also depends on how your clients, what sort of rules they have. Some clients say, okay, block everything except these three ports, and then it's easy. And some say, hey, open up everything, and then, you know.
What's even easier, I mean, if you just go the source and destination from a specific IP is what I want to know. Well, all the traffic that's sourced from or destined to this IP, just like a co-location firm would do it, right? I mean, that's what you want to know. In that case, if you were to do it on a monthly basis, you would, I mean, is there a cumulative way to do it at the end of the month based on syslog output? I mean, you know, from PF or what? I mean, how would you do it? Wouldn't it be...
Well, you can do it if you never reload your PF rules, which when you reload the rules, it will clear the counters. You can do it on the first of the month and the last of the month, but I'm not sure that's practical, because no one will go, well, I'm not sure. You know, you can, for example, every 2 hours or whatever works, display the rules and put it in a database with the, you know, cumulative one, and then you just do selects in the database.
You can keep priority databases really cheaply and keep long historicals and keep a really nice granular view of like the last 2 months or something.
Yeah, exactly. You can.
But with all the media, a limited amount of space for the labels.
I think every sample is every 5 minutes.
That's not a sample rate, it's like being able to name the actually
track. Yeah, naming, yeah, you kind of see how it goes.
If you're dealing with like labels based on IPs, it's pretty simple.
You can also do, for example, client name colon IP. Whatever, you know, would help you. And it can be different from client to client, depends how they set up their stuff.
Do you think there's any risk in designing your own self-inflicted file service attack by tracking
them? No, I don't think so. This is just this is same as anything else they have done for traffic, keeping track of states. I mean, you can maybe overload some counters, but it will mess up your accounting, I guess. I don't think there are worse things if it's you should attack something else.
I
okay, so I'm looking at the OpenBSD man page right now for pf.com.
Uh-oh.
It says in addition to destination port, you can put source address, source port, interface, or the rule number, or the protocol.
Right.
people. So you have six choices we can put in that list. Let's say you can track the source IP and source port. Pick your one. Just look, man, the get.com.
Yeah, thank you. I remembered something, but I wasn't sure. Let's get the check.
Do you have any experience with this, using this on lag interfaces, bonded interfaces?
No, sorry, I'm limited to what I do.
The trunk.
Yeah. Trunk. Yeah, no, very simple.
Trunk. Right. What about Clark firewall? Yeah.
It probably is the same. If you have it in PF, if you have an interface and a rule, you can put label on it.
Yeah, it should be fine.
Then you also have to be careful if they close open
tracking
the statistics
from
the other.
Yeah, that's what's actually
why.
Yeah.
I wanted to break.
I need a break from those baby.
Yeah, you ready for yourself.
Okay, thank you.
It's been a long time coming, bro. Thank you.
Hey, I got a mouse. Go to slide. Woohoo! Uh-oh.
Fun. Pedos is like a competitive thing. Pedos is fun.
Alright, again, by show of hands, who in the last week has used TCP DOM? Any particular reasons?
Client complaining that they can't reach their machine past our firewall.
So you're checking for what?
Look at the internal interface, look at the external interface, make sure that we were passing their packets through, and if we were, then it means their network signal's false.
What was the device?
Device? On their end or on our end?
What were you running the TCP dump on? No, server, a switch.
X86 machine, firewall.
Okay, it's a firewall. Okay. Who else? I know you had your hand up. Gina.
You want to know what I did with it?
Sure. What were you doing? What were you looking for?
Let's see. Last 3 hours, mostly just making sure packets come out of my drivers correctly.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So you're doing it for development's sake?
Yeah.
Quality assurance?
Well, I mean, I used to speed up every day, multiple times. Yeah. I'm probably the poster child for it at this point.
All right, well, feel free to correct me.
I will try to.
I mean it. All right, so TCPDOM history, not much is available out there. It's written in 1987, but it looks like a fellow who might be Dutch or from Northern Europe somewhere.
No, no, no.
Not at all.
Jacobson is an American who's one of the people who actually fixed all of TCP and prevented the network from collapsing. And he and Craig and Steve McCain were at LBL.
Yes.
Berkeley, so they wrote this because they needed to debug 10 10 meg Ethernet at the time.
Okay, so why the name?
Why TCPDump?
Yes.
Because you're dumping the TCP state.
Okay, that's all I want to know.
And basically, you know, it's just a wrapper around the PCAP, which they also know.
Okay, so PCAP is a predecessor to TCPDump.
No, PCAP is a library that TCPDump uses to understand what data is coming off the line.
So they come in like this.
Packet capture library, yes. And then TCPDump is using it.
Alright, so as you guys know, it's ubiquitous across Unix and Unix like OS's BSD license, and Wireshark can handle the output, which is pretty handy. Common syntax, real simple stuff, TCP dump options expression, you can see this in the man page. Most easy thing to look for is the dash I. You usually want that dash I, especially when you're dealing with firewalls. Like if you got a NATing situation, that you're not sure if your traffic's being NATed, you can look for your source IP, your NATed host, see if it's coming out the external interface of the firewall. So of course you got to get that on the external interface. So you have to specify it, and so you say the host, and then the name is going to be either an IP address or a resolvable host name. Otherwise, you specify ports. You can. And the thing is that you gotta use Boolean logic along with it, otherwise it's not gonna parse out. So you've gotta have that little conjunction there, that and then the rest of your syntax for the rest of your expression. More common syntax, you have if you wanna write out this your output to a file, so maybe you can import it later into Wireshark for more inspection or easier means of a graphical means of looking at your output. You just use the W for write, and if you're going to read it, you can write down your command line before you execute it off, and you use that dash R and the file name. And so if you're going to use something else besides TCP, you need to specify the protocol. Or you should, I suppose. And TCP, is there an exception to that? Is there an exception when you wouldn't use specify the protocol besides TCP? Well, can you get away with seeing ICMP traffic without specifying specifically ICMP?
For ICMP,
by default, I'll put everything on that link type. So it's
your permission.
Okay,
so it's whatever's on the Ethernet traffic is going to be. So if you don't want to see everything else associated with that host, you should specify the protocol.
By the way, the more complex rules you use, the fewer packets you're going to capture.
Absolutely. And you'll see some nice examples of that. You know, concatenate a lot of Boolean expressions. Absolutely. Yes.
Are you going to cover that packet loss bit?
Packet loss bit? What do you mean?
Oh, just if you're not capturing a lot, do you mean you're going to miss packets, or do you mean you're going to slow your link down while you continue to capture every single packet?
You won't slow the link down because UPF doesn't block on copying the amount for sure. You won't slow the link down.
Okay. Apparently, I copied the same thing twice. Oh well, twice the fun. All right, here's a more more complicated expression. You have your interface. I'm writing it out to a file, testing.cap. I want port 80, and I want it between this destination and that source. The dot 3 for the destination and the dot 2. What might be problematic with that expression? Okay, so what's going to be problematic with the traffic that you're going to see? Or what might be problematic or might be unexpected?
It'll hang on DNS resolution because you forgot hyphen N.
there's no name, so IP address. It's not resolving anything.
That's the problem. They don't try to get the PTR records for those things.
Yeah.
Okay, I've never seen that. So, apart from that, what might be the problem?
If it's loaded on these type of web server, you're going to be seeing transactions in both directions, whereas you're probably expecting.
You won't see transactions in both directions. you won't see transaction in both directions. That's the problem. Or might be the problem, or an unexpected behavior. Just because you have, it's definitely going to be absolute, it's going to be very literal here. It's only going to look at it when the packet's coming from the dot 3 and going to the dot 2. Period. Alright. And the parentheses, very important, they do have to be escaped. At least with the shells I use. I don't know, maybe you got a special shell.
You made a CCP dump shell?
So, my
shell reason.
Hey. So the next one, here's a nice little trick you learn when you see all your traffic, when you SSH to a host and you're trying to see what other SSH traffic might be going on, but all you see is your own and you know you're trying to send it first, and so you can knock it out. Like if you're coming from the dot two and whatever host you're going to, and you can avoid seeing your own traffic. So and not. So there's all kinds of logical Boolean logic syntax. You can use symbols or literals in the sense of words. I don't want to get confused with programming languages there. So, all right, so we got negation, concatenation, and alternation. I tend not to like the symbols. I've not had consistent results with that. So I like using the words. It's easier to read for me. Alright, differences in syntax. In this one, this is a just an ICMP capture of me pinging the dot 3. You got your request coming from the dot 2.
There's the DNS record.
Yes, absolutely right. And it's local though at least. So if it's not locally resolvable, if your local host name's not there, it might be problematic. Or more so. Or media problematic. So and your ID for the session. Or I guess you can call it sessions, and then your sequence numbers. And the next slide, I only made one difference, and that's adding. All right, sorry guys. This that's supposed to be dash VI right here. For some reason I removed it during my editing. Okay, so you get a whole lot more information that you may or may not want. But if you want to learn a protocol, TCP dump can be very helpful. Now, my point with this is that...
Yeah. Go to this next screen now. Yeah, right there.
Yeah, this is double V. This one was single V. Some reason erased it. I remember seeing two dashes, but anyway, I screwed that up. So, there's really not much difference here outside of the sequence number, which, like, the time I did between these two was, like, sequence 500 and sequence 1240, so... And there's another ID there and a time. But so sometimes the extra V is not as verbose as you might think. Troubleshooting shortcuts. When I do troubleshooting on firewalls, again, it's often NAT problems. You gotta make sure what's going on. I'll set variables. Now, that's most often I work with are actually C shell based firewalls, that the IPSO, Nokia's IPSO appliances. So it'd be set space desk, and then the IP address, set space blah blah blah. And that can be very helpful when, particularly if you got a complicated expression with multiple, you don't want to have to write out the IP address multiple times, or you have multiple IP addresses that you need to test with the exact same thing. So, for example, host 1, host 2, host 3, for some reason you're looking for this traffic between with two sources, host 1 and going to host 2, or going from host 1 to host 3, or between host 2 and host 3. So, you can save you writing out the IP addresses, maybe getting them wrong, and if you're dealing with an archaic shell, not having to push control H too much. I should say questions. Any questions? No? A couple of references. I'm going to put this up on BillTopman.com. Maybe a link. A nice bug. And as a bonus, some of you guys have seen this before. I gave it to you at the BSDCom last year. CD to temp, make a directory called test, CD to test, LS, redirect into content.txt, temp content.txt was the content of content.txt. Why? Now you guys said it correctly, I didn't hear you.
It's content.txt, but the shell creates the file first, then it starts the file with declaration.
Why might it do that?
Because it has to create the file description before it can take LS.
And what if the resource isn't available? Right?
Okay. I guess it's when you take LS, like, you can create the file system and fail to be there.
Nice little Unix test there. Well, thank you all. Any questions?